Special number 25185, Reel 6.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your job on the Minesweeper and what that involved?
Well, there were three seamen POs, and they rotated so that everybody knew each other's job. So, as I said, I started on the upper deck as captain of the forecastle. I then went to the sweep deck, and then I finished up as PO of the mess decks, so that you had an experience of all the work that was on the Minesweeper.
What was your work on the sweep deck like?
Well, I was in charge of getting the sweeps out and making sure everything was running smoothly, putting on the cutters on the sweep wire, and making sure that when the wires came in that they were put on the reel correctly. And in fact, you had a lieutenant, but I was virtually in charge of the seamen on the sweep deck.
And where would the wires be?
That everything submerged? was on aft, or what on other ships would be the quarter deck, all the sweep, the reels, and everything was on the after part of the ship, and all the wires went over the stern and were trailed from the stern.
How many wires were there?
It depending. If you were just sweeping, there was just one wire out. But if you were doing an A sweep, which was a clearance sweep, then you had wires out either side because you joined up with another ship. And so how many ships was in the flotilla were all joined up, and you dragged this wire or these wires across the sea bed to ensure that that particular area was then clear of mines.
And you said you worked in a flotilla, so there'd be a number of ships.
Yes. Yeah. We had two problems, actually. The first one was that we used to get a lot of dummy mines. That was, instead of the mine being on a wire, this dummy mine was on a chain. And if you caught one of these in the sweeps, it meant that you had to pull out to disengage this this dummy mine. On the True Love, we used to take six army personnel from the Royal Engineers, and six sailors used to go up and have a week's army life, and vice versa. And they were watching us one day, and we got several of these dummy mines in the sweeps. And because we had to get rid of the chain, ditch the dummy mine, and it was all on a shackle. And if you can just imagine that probably some of these mines had been in the sea for 2 or 3 years, they was all corroded up. And it took quite a while to undo this shackle. And one of the engineers said, "Haven't you got any settling equipment on board?" So we said, "No." So he said, "Well, next week, when the next lot come, we'll bring some settling equipment with us," which they did. And we were the first ship that tried this out, and because the other ships in flotilla couldn't understand why we were so quick to get back and start sweeping again, where they were struggling to get rid of their mines. And so it was then universal. Each ship then had settling equipment, and they sort of burnt through the chain. That went down to the bottom of the thing. And then sunk the dummy mine.
How big were these mines?
Quite large. I don't know the actual diameter, but they were quite big. And if we used to have MTBs to disperse and explode these mines, but if it got there were too many, then each the flotilla would stop sweeping, and we'd each go to a section and try to sink these mines. On the forecastle, each side, we had what we called an elephant gun that was used in Africa to kill or coal elephants, and that it was quite a heavy gun. And on top of that, we used to have sailors laying down in a prone position, firing a 303 rifle to try to explode these mines, because while they were floating about, they were a hazard and a danger. So until they were all cleared, you couldn't continue sweeping. The next problem we had was when we were sweeping off of Italy, the Germans had invented a mine that once it was cut and it came to the surface, it exploded. And so the first two ships in the line were all in what we called slack water, so to ensure that there were no mines in that, and that the third ship would be cutting if there were any mines. So, and they were traced by ASDIC. But if the ASDIC failed or something went wrong, you were in real trouble. But fortunately, we didn't have any casualties, but they were quite a hazard.
Tell me about some of the live mines that you recovered.
Well, some of them used to come up and they'd be covered with barnacles, and others that had been just recently laid, sort of glistened in the sun. But they were an awful sight, really, when you think that, you could hit one of those and that would be curtains. So it wasn't a very pleasant sight.
And you used to shoot at them to set them off?
Yeah, and we used to shoot at them. Used to try and shoot at one of the horns on it, because that was where the explosive part, and where, if you touch that, that's when the mine exploded.
How far away would your ship be from the mines when they were exploding?
Oh, 500 yards. No, quite close, because, they used to come up. I mean, the sweep would be out, and they would come up within that sort of distance from the ship, but at the stern. No, you wouldn't see them. You'd have to look over the stern to see them, because that's where they were being cut.
And you were clearing mines in the Mediterranean?
Yeah. We actually finished that in about September 46, and then we were in Malta, and there was some trouble in Albania, and they'd laid some mines in the Corfu Channel, and we had to go up there and we had to sweep that, and that's when two destroyers were badly damaged. And we, after we'd finished sweeping and cleared this channel, we had to tow one of the destroyers, or we tried to tow this destroyer back to Malta. I was in charge on the sweep deck, and we eventually got the ship in tow, but due to the rough weather, we had to disengage, and she eventually was took in control by a tug, and we went back to Malta. Not long after, I was told that I was being drafted back to England, and I left Malta on the Enard Bay, December 1946. We got to Plymouth, and I thought I was taking passage, that I would be leaving the ship and going back to Chatham. But such was my luck that when we got to Plymouth, I was informed that I wouldn't be going back to Chatham. I was to stay on the Enard Bay to pay the ship off. After over 2 years in the Mediterranean, I was given a few days for Christmas leave,
And so you hadn't been home at all during that time?
No, I was been away over 2 years. And
how had you spent your free time then, if you hadn't been allowed any home leave?
Well, we used to go run ashore in Malta, which was always a good time, and the other Salonika was very nice, and Piraeus, we had some quite good runs ashore, but other than that, nothing. Most of the time, we was at sea from Monday to Friday. We'd come in and store ship, make sure we had got all the provisions. So you had Saturday and Sunday, and if you one of those days you were duty, so that only meant that you were allowed ashore one day out of two. So you didn't get much free time at all.
Anyway, sorry, you to interrupt. You
1946, I think. I came home December 1946, and as I said, I had this leave. Went back, paid the ship off. Eventually arrived back in Chatham in the April. I had the remainder of my leave and went back to to the barracks. And at that time, there were more POs than there was ordinary or able seaman rates. So instead of the able seaman rates doing all the guard duties, etc., it was all petty officers. And I did that for a while, and then their lordships decided that they were going to have a censor of everybody that was in Chatham Barracks. So in their wisdom, they decided that the more people they could get out of the barracks before the deadline started, the better it would be. And so there were 6 petty officers. We were sent to join HMS Hayne at Portland.
Were you given the opportunity to leave the Navy after the war?
That will come a bit later. I was, but on joining the AIN, as I said, there were 6 extra POs. They didn't want us, but they had to put up with us. In fact, they had to make another PO's mess to accommodate us.
What sort of vessel was there?
She was a battle class destroyer, and she was operating from Portland in the Home Fleet. And actually, by joining her, my life changed in a lot of ways. For once, I got on with the captain of the ship, and that's where I met, it was while at Portland I met my wife. And life on there was very good. In spite of all being overcrowded, it was a happy ship, and we had a good PO's mess, and we had a good sports facility, a good team, water polo, football, cricket, boxing, and I really enjoyed it on there. As I said, I met my wife whilst I was there, and I was married in December of 47. I then left the AIN to go to Chatham for another gunnery course, during which time I was informed that my wife was expecting twins, and that put me, my mind wasn't on any gunnery or anything, so I failed the preliminary to be a gunnery instructor, and my twin boys were born in the August of 48. And I left Chatham after that, and I went to Culham, which was an air station, and I was there for about 12 months, and that took us into, that'd be 49. Came back to Chatham, 48, 49, and I then, my wife was expecting again. And I was then told I got a draft ship to HMS London that was in the Far East, and that was when the Korean War was on. I went home and told my wife, and something went wrong that she had to go in the hospital, and she was in hospital quite a while, and through loss of blood and everything. And I didn't join the London, and I applied for compassionate draft, and I was told that I would join the Vanguard, which was sea training at Portland.
Had you been effectively shore-based for most of those last few years?
The only shore base I had was HMS Cullum, which was an air station, or the interim period, you know, while waiting ships in Chatham Barracks. But
when you're on HMS Hain, presumably you were at Portland quite a lot.
Yes, yeah. Because we were attached to the home fleet as it was, because it was reduced down from quite a size to one cruiser and four destroyers, of which we were one, so you can just imagine. And it was during that time that, as I said, I got married, and the captain sent for me and sat me down, and he said, I hope you're not thinking about leaving the Navy. I said, well, it hadn't crossed my mind. He said, I know you've just got married, and at that time they were giving golden handshakes or golden boulders to a lot of people, and he said that he hoped that I wouldn't be one of them, because the Navy still needed trained and petty officers, etc. And so I just put it out of my head and carried on. And as I said, the aim was the making, because he gave me a superior as a petty officer, which I never lost for the remainder of my time in the Navy, and that's quite a record, really. You know, if your class is superior, then you're at the top of the tree, as one might say. After leaving, I went to the Vanguard, and my wife lost the baby, and I stayed on the Vanguard until I was drafted again to Chatham for another gunnery course, which was QR, Quarters Rating 1, which was a first class gunnery rate, which I passed. And at the end of it, which was 1952, I was sent for by the drafting commander, and he said, you know that you now do for a foreign commission. I said, yes, I quite understand. He said, you have been selected to be drafted to HMS Surprise. So I said, oh yes, what's HMS Surprise? He said, she's the dispatch vessel of CNC Med Fleet, but she has been, or is being brought home to be converted to the Royal Yacht for the review, fleet review in 53, which was the Queen's coronation review. And he said that we hope that you think about this. And I said, well, I've got to go, I'll accept. And I eventually joined the Surprise. She was brought home and put into dockyard in December 1952, and we worked from December right round to the actual review. We gutted the ship, we scraped the ship side, we burnished it and everything, and then the dockyard mates took over, and she was painted all in enamel. All the raw compartments were, all the compartments down aft were updated to the Royal Yacht standard. And the Queen eventually arrived on board the day before the review at Portsmouth, the railway jetty, and we sailed through the fleet that Monday afternoon, and we were the Royal Yacht for 48 hours. She slept on board, she dined on board and everything.
What was it like? What was the review like? Describe it.
Well, it was magnificent, you know, because we went through all the lines of ships, and there were quite a lot of ships of all nations. And
were they like? Were they decked with flags?
Or they were dressed overall, and it was a magnificent sight. And as you went by, all the ships cheered, and it took about 2.5 hours there, and it was a great honour to be there and to think that we were leading the fleet, sort of thing. After that, we went back into Portsmouth. We got rid of all the Royal Yacht regalia, and we had 72 hours leave each watch, and we sailed for the Med about a week after the review to take over as dispatch vessel for Lord Mountbatten.
What does it mean, being dispatch vessel?
Well, that... it was entitled the CNC to have his family on board. He had accommodation in Malta, but if the fleet went out, then the wife and family would come aboard, and we would sail with the fleet, so that his wife and entourage was always with him, you know, wherever we went.
On a separate ship?
Yeah, this is on the Surprise. All the family, and then the fleet went off, and then when they got into various harbours, we would be there, you know, to welcome them, sort of thing. And we had...
Terribly expensive.
But there it was. That was his privilege. There was two. There was a Surprise for the Med, and the Alert, which was for the CNC, which was based in Hong Kong. We had quite a few celebrities. We had Sir Anthony Eden. He came aboard to recuperate after his operation when I think they took a lung out or something. But and we used to have Sir Malcolm Sargent. There was quite a controversy about Sir Malcolm, because the Sunday Express didn't have a lot of time for Mountbatten, and they wrote an article about it, that Malcolm Sargent was being entertained at the Country's Express on the Surprise. So Mountbatten got his own back, and made him honorary director of naval music for the Mediterranean Fleet. So that meant that he could come out and listen to the band, sort of thing, that was all right.
So it's open to the Commander-in-Chief to invite whoever he wants?
Yeah, more or less, yes. He used to...
Private yacht, effectively.
We used to say it was his yacht, sort of thing, you know. And then... As I said, we had Sir Anthony Eden and Lady Eden. And then when we used to go around, we had the King and Queen of Greece, President of Turkey. We went up to Yugoslavia, as it was then, and we went up to Tito's hideout, and he came aboard. And we met all the big dignitaries that were in the Mediterranean, and that was more or less our job, showing the flag and making sure that we put on a good show, sort of thing.
What was your particular job?
I was then the chief bosun's mate, which meant that I was in charge of all the seamen, in charge of the ordinary day working, painting ship, the cleanliness of the ship, the running. I was more or less the first lieutenant's right-hand man, and so I had to make sure that everything was going tickety-boo.
Did you personally have the opportunity to meet any of these famous people?
We saw them, but I was never introduced to any of them, not face-to-face. But it was still, we saw them, and that was something, I suppose. This went on, that was 53, all through 53, 54, and then in the December, after we'd been round all the bases, we'd taken Mountbatten, because he was then coming back to England, and he was going to be CNC in London. And we left Malta in December to take him up to Sicily, where he was going to fly from an aerodrome in Sicily to Paris, which was then in his domain. It was where NATO headquarters was in Paris, and it came at in his Mediterranean area. We arrived there early Sunday morning, and it was pouring with rain, and I was told that I was make sure that none of the luggage or any of their personal luggage, so I was doing that, and they then piped clear lower deck, muster aft, and one of the ratings said, "Are you going, Buffer?" I said, "Well, no, I don't think I'll stop here and look after this." And he said, "I think you better go." So we fell in on the quarter deck, or the poop deck, and the first lieutenant came along and he said, "I want you to be in the front rank." So I was always a bit argumentative. I said, "Well, I'm all right here." And he said, "I want you in the front rank." So I just stood in the front rank. And Lord Mountbatten was always one to talk, wherever he went, he liked to talk to the troops and that. And he went through, his 2 years on the surprise, and he thanked us all very much for what we'd done. He said, "I know some of the fishing trips, because he used to go out with sit under water diving and shooting and weekends, and because that meant that we were at sea at weekends when the natives who had their wives out would have loved to have been at home." He said, "But I thank you for all that." And then he went on to say, "As you know, that as CNC, I'm allowed to promote so many people during the course of my office." And he said, "I've saved one for HMS Surprise." So with that, he said, "I would like the chief bosun's mate to step forward." And somebody pushed me and they said, "That's you." And because I went up and I saluted him, his wife and daughter were there, and he said, "I promote you chief petty officer as from December the 9th. Congratulations." And to this day, I can't remember if I saluted him or what I did. I was in such a diz sort of thing, that he taken the trouble to promote me to chief petty officer. And that was, I think, must have been the pinnacle of my naval career. And he left the ship, we went back to Malta, she went in, we took her into dockyard, and we lived ashore, and we used to go to the ship every day. And then I was told I was being drafted back to England. That was after 2 years.